Hi, Glenn. How are you doing?
Doing very well here at the Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv, and this is our, I don't know, umpteenth BloggingHeads conversation. John, you're a regular at the
Dozens.
Glenn Show.
Dozens by now. That's right.
Very
Yeah.
fortunate to have you participating. And today, we're the self-appointed black guys at BloggingHeads.tv. That's a part of our designation, and it seemed like an appropriate thing for us to weigh in on the brouhahas that have erupted in recent weeks around questions of race. So there is Cliven Bundy, the rancher out in the West who has been grazing his cattle on federal lands and has created something of a conflict, became a conservative hero, and then was caught making certain remarks about black folks that were very upsetting. And then there was Donald Sterling. When Donald Sterling, a billionaire Southern California businessman, owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, who was apparently recorded making certain statements about not liking it that black people were being brought to his games and about how he was responsible for feeding and clothing these million-dollar athletes who play for his team, et cetera, and has been sanctioned by the National Basketball Association, banned for life, and there's been just an awful lot of talk. We're coming in kind of late on this subject, but John, I know you're always got something to say. So, what do you got to say about all of this?
Well, I hope you won't think that I'm punting in saying that the two episodes, and I'm sure that you probably felt the same way. When you first read about them, you thought, oh, that again, and life will go on. Then you watched, pardon me if I'm projecting, as the media went crazy over it, and you realized that maybe it was time to think about it a little harder. And there are things to say about both Cliven and Bundy and Mr. Sterling, but in the grand scheme of things, what strikes me is that in 2 weeks, for some reason, there's going to be some wise person who says that America doesn't want to talk about race, or that America is in denial about race, or that there needs to be a conversation about race in this country. Nobody wants to talk about it. I remember I was on an NPR black show a very long time ago where the host during one of the downtimes was saying, nobody wants to talk about race. And we were doing it on the show. And I didn't know the phrase yet. And so I was thinking, what must he mean? Because aren't we talking about it? This is a perfect example in that the country has been talking about race an awful lot with Bundy and with Sterling. And yet the same people, I'm sure, are still going to say America doesn't want to talk about it, which means that they must mean some other kind of conversation. But they certainly can't mean that people tiptoe around talking about race at all. And anybody who says that from now on really needs to think about what things have been like in the media here for the past 2 weeks, which is not at all unusual. Do you think America doesn't want to talk about race?
I think you're making an interesting point. I think there certainly has been a lot of airtime occasioned by these particular incidents about race. I have heard said exactly what you're complaining about, which is we don't want to talk about race. We need a conversation on race. What I think the people who are saying that mean is this is the tip of an iceberg somehow. This is the most egregious expression of a deep-seated animus, antagonism, stigma, contempt, or whatever, and that we need to ferret out at the root the problem rather than to simply sanction particular individuals who have gone to an extreme in expressing what many others are wise enough to know they shouldn't say out loud. That's what I think they mean. Now, they may be wrong about that, but
No.
surely we're talking, but are we really talking about the stuff that needs to be talked about? That's what I think
Right.
some people are trying to ask.
Now, can I push that a little further? Because it's
Do.
not that those people are wrong, because clearly that is what they mean. I think that language slips away from meaning, and in saying we don't talk about it, clearly that's not what they mean. They mean that we're not talking about the real thing. But still, there's a slip between the language and the meaning. Because in 2014, what do they mean by we're going to ferret it out, that we have to identify the real issues? It seems to me that they're not referring anymore to anything that could actually happen in real life, or even that they can quite conceive of. I think we've learned to say something without being sure that we're really making some sort of prescription for action. So, for example, remember the film The Help from about 3 years ago.
Sure.
Well, I remember Nelson George, who is an august critic of popular culture, often usually black popular culture. He's very good on hip hop. He said in a piece on The Help in the Times that the film did not come to terms with the injustice of those circumstances, such as the assassination of Medgar Evers, which of course was part of the film. And I thought to myself then, and this is not to be ad hominem against him in particular, what would the coming to terms mean? What are the terms? Under what conditions would someone like him say, yes, the terms have been come to? I think it's just become a kind of a slogan. I'm not sure where it goes. Do you know what terms means? How would we come to terms?
Yeah, again, I think you're making a decent point. It can't simply be an expression of regret, a kind of mea culpa. The terms
Because that wouldn't be enough.
that no, it wouldn't be, and it wouldn't get at. I think we can't leave the Cliven and Bundy guy out of this because part, I say this with great trepidation. Of what leads assholes like him to say stupid stuff like what he said that is racist, okay, is that they're looking around at some districts in American cities. They're looking at what's going on in the municipal court and at the county jail. They're watching who's queuing up for the welfare, and they're seeing a disproportionate presence of African Americans in those situations. And therefore, they're feeling empowered and justified in drawing these kind of negative stereotypic conclusions and expressing them because to them it may seem practically obvious. What did I say that was wrong? Can't you see those people sitting in front of the door drinking their 40-ounce brews at 12 o'clock in the middle of the day and not apparently engaged in any gainful employment? They're saying. Can't you see those families unable to support themselves with children they never should have had who are queuing up in the welfare lines? Can't you see the rate at which the violent crimes perpetrated in this country are disproportionately carried out by young black men and so forth and so on? So, again, let me just say it. I'm not, in observing this, justifying anything that that stupid, ignorant, offensive, racist said. But I'm saying coming to terms, you asked me the question, what would it mean to come to terms? In some people's mind, might be changing those facts on the ground so that they no longer, because those facts are understood to embody the present day consequence of a legacy and a history of help like, help the film, the help like racism, okay? We've not yet come to terms with that because our jails are still overflowing with young black men, because the welfare rolls are overly represented with mothers who can't support their children who happen to be of African descent, and so on and so forth. Now, it may be that they don't have in mind any particular policy that we could have confidence would actually achieve the results that they want, but they want the country to be committed to doing something about the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. That's what I think they mean.
Right, okay. That makes sense. And so for them, coming to terms would mean that someone like Cliven Bundy would understand the reason for the disproportions that he sees and would not decide that it has something to do with any inherent quality of black people.
Or
Because
if
the
he's not capable of understanding that, at least enough other people, some of them in the Republican Party, would so understand that
Sure.
legislative action could be taken, or at least, some kind of philanthropic and programmatic intervention could be mounted, and
Right.
the narrative would be redrawn in a way that acknowledged
Yeah.
the role that the history of racism has played in this present day circumstance. I think
And
so.
see that, okay, so let's say that that's what people are waiting for, and that seems like a perfect layout of how it goes. I think in terms of a prognostication that nobody would consider too pessimistic, that is not gonna happen. We're not gonna have a national effort aimed specifically at black people, nor are we going to see the kind of anti-poverty initiative that someone like Marion Wright Edelman would prefer. And so it
Well, that's
means
too
that,
bad, isn't it?
yeah, I mean, is that going to happen?
Well,
Is it going to
Andy Black,
be?
I mean, not aimed at black people specifically, but the idea that we could mobilize to try to do something about the what's wrong at the bottom rungs of our society where some blacks are stuck. It's too bad to have to acknowledge that it ain't going to happen. I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, the right thing, and I do think that's the right thing, is at least a possibility, even of a long shot.
Well, don't you think that, and once again, this is not to dump on somebody who I think is a major race and poverty crusader, but somebody like Marion Wright Edelman thinks that it's about money, that we need to go back to what the Great Society never quite got around to doing. And whether or not we think that would work, I don't see that happening, that we have people banging gavels and shunting billions and billions of dollars into troubled inner city neighborhoods with the idea that that's going to do it. And if that doesn't happen for a lot of people, then nothing has been done. That if we're not going to go back to 1965, then that's it. In which case, I'm afraid that there's a certain person who is going to feel that America has simply never come to the terms. And in which case, Charles Blow in the Times had a piece that I think encapsulated what I think of as sort of the Upper West Side view of these things, but also certainly where you live too, which is that really, even if we're all right in thinking Cliven and Bundy and Donald Sterling are idiots, we can't help thinking that us sitting around and tweeting and chatting and putting them down while we drink our wine really isn't as important as working on what is often called institutional racism. But the reason we don't is because that's so much harder. Now, some people might think that all we need to do is call for lots of money to be poured into the nation's ghettos. I'm of the opinion that that approach alone didn't work, and I wonder if anybody really knows what in combination with that would. So these two events make me sad because I think today's version of being a crusader is for everybody to sit and nod that Donald Sterling is a bad guy. When let's face it, he formed his opinions before television and penicillin. He'll be dead in 5 years, or from what I've heard, 5 weeks. And so this is not exactly America today. Cliven Bundy isn't a young man really either. But how do you fight the real thing? And that's where I sometimes wonder whether we can ever achieve any kind of consensus, even on what you would call the left. You know what I mean?
Here's what I think, John. I'm with you, and I think again there's merit in what you say. What I think is that it's way past time. We're now in the year 2014. Okay, I mean, as these anniversaries, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 having its 50th,
Brown
the
v. Board
Brown it's
next
going to have
week.
its 60th this month, exactly. As these anniversaries come upon us and you realize, well, heck, I was alive in 1954, but, you know, just barely, that a lot of time has gone by. The narrative has got to change. The thing that most deeply unsettled me about the reaction to these racist comments, and I repeat again, they were racist comments, they were stupid comments, they have no place in American life, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that most troubled me about it was that everybody was, you know, quick to jump on the bandwagon of condemning these ugly racists and demanding their heads on a platter, you know, because that's the kind of payoff that black people can get these days when we go and we complain about something. Everybody's prepared to say, yeah. They're prepared to nod, and they're prepared to join the party that takes the miscreant over there and strings them up on a tree, you know? I'm sorry for the metaphor. I know people will be upset about that.
You
Real
know,
black
maybe
people were strung
spanks
on
him.
real trees, billionaires, et cetera, but you know what I'm saying. Destroy their reputation, ruin their business lives, make them personas non grata, et cetera. Everybody's prepared to join on that in a heartbeat because that's the easiest and cheapest way to show a kind of acknowledgement of this moral claim that black people are supposed to have, which moral claim can't actually get anything done. Okay? The Latino Hispanics have way more sway, being a swing voting population in critical states that everybody is whatever. We're getting ready to rewrite the immigration laws in part so that either party can attract their votes. Way more sway. I'm not against immigration reform people. They're getting way more influence and way more attention than the predictable African American left Democratic vote that you can count on. And we don't actually have any power. The only power we have is to pout, throw a tantrum, and have everybody around the room say, yeah, you're right. Those are racist. They shouldn't treat you like that.
That's right. And you know what the problem with it is that we human beings tend not to think historically. It's not natural to think, linguists call it diachronic versus synchronic. Let's not use those terms, but one goes through time. And ideally, if you're trying to get something done, you look every 10 years or so at whether or not progress has been made. That's hard because, you know, all of us live in the present. But myself, and you must feel this way even more than I do, I've now been writing from the sidelines about race issues for 15 years. I've been doing this for a while. It's gotten to the point where when something like Sterling comes up, I have to work to think, what can I say that I didn't say in 2004 or 2008? And often the answer is nothing. It starts to feel kind of cyclical. And the problem is, how many people are realizing that, I can think back to Trent Lott and what he said about how Strom Thurmond would have made a great president. And everybody made all sorts of noise, including me, and I was making noise on what would be considered the PC side. It was one of the first times I really disappointed the right wing. And well, now here we are. Michael Richards, the Kramer comedian from Seinfeld, used the N-word in a comedy routine. Oh, we didn't like that. Around the same time as that was George Allen and the macaca comment. And all of this noise was made. All of us patted each other on the back. And here we are. People are still popping up with this sort of thing every few months. And you're right. Unfortunately, there is a sense that to be a proper thinking black person is to get really, outraged about one of these things whenever it comes up, acting like each one is a teaching moment that's actually going to change anything. When really, it doesn't change anything in terms of whether or not certain rapscallions feel like saying nigger every now and then. And in the meantime, the societal conditions we're talking about stay the same. Glenn, very quickly, I want to say this. I must
Well,
admit,
John, you
this very quickly, very quickly. When I heard about Donald Sterling, I got a little bit of a vomitous feeling. And the vomitous feeling was because I thought, here we go again with this useless outrage. Anyway, go ahead.
No, I was okay. I know that feeling. And again, I think your points have merit. I was going to say, just to complete the thought that I had earlier, I said, it's been a long time and we're weak. That is, African American advocates are weak in our capacity to exert real leverage over real stuff. And it's cheap grace for the rest of the society to join our bandwagon and express how appalled they are at the racism that still exists and so on, which doesn't change anything on the ground. I had made that point, but I wanted to make another point. I think in the 21st century, those of us who are deeply concerned, as I know you are, about the well-being of African Americans and other Americans, the narrative needs to change from a backward-looking, we had slavery, Jim Crow, and weren't treated right, to something else. And I have some ideas in mind about what that something else may be. One of them, one is class, not race. Now, in the context of the affirmative action decision that the Supreme Court handed down recently, and all of the talk about how affirmative action needs to be reformed, that's an easy thing to say. But I don't just mean affirmative action. I mean that the issue here is poverty, lack of education, poor housing, poor public health, unemployment, decimated family structures. And there are a lot of white people in those situations. Indeed, Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, of a couple of years ago, my colleague and friend Robert Putnam, the distinguished political scientist, is at work
Bowling
right
alone.
now. Yeah, Bowling Alone, that was his big book. But he's at work right now on another masterwork, which is to chronicle the extent to which inequality amongst white people is having a devastating effect and creating like two different life courses that can be followed by individuals depending upon whether or not their parents finished high school. Are they living in a trailer park somewhere or in a low income or whatever? Are they, drug addicted, children out of wedlock? There are all these indicators of social dysfunction that have expanded enormously in the last two generations amongst the low income people in poverty. So one change in the narrative that I think is desperately needed is finding a way to join the historic claims of African Americans that are derived out of slavery and Jim Crow segregation and subordination and racial stigma, and putting that weight behind a broader, I'm going to call it progressive, but Republicans are welcome, platform that aims to do something about the bottom of American society to court. That's one point. Another point, though, I think, is that these problems that we're talking about can be viewed in a global and not only in a national frame. To talk about the history of the United States and slavery, which is 150 years old, or Jim Crow segregation, which was dying in the 1960s and is now dead, to talk about that is parochial in a way that I think is really unhelpful. I mean, for example, I'll give one example. The U.S. incarcerates at a rate that's higher than any other country in the world by an order of magnitude. Okay? Any other rich country, certainly by an order of magnitude. That's a racial issue amongst other issues because of the footprint of that system in the lives of African Americans. It's also a human rights issue. It's a human rights issue that can be posed in a global framework. So when we botch an execution of what happened to be an African American in Oklahoma who was convicted of a heinous crime and was being punished for it, when we botch that execution, people cringe in Dusseldorf. You know what I mean? In Milan, they shift in their seats. They say, what kind of country is this? There's leverage there. There's the potential to frame the questions that we're raising, not as you owe us something because of slavery, but as what kind of country do you pretend to be, leader of the free world, and yet you preside over this? So I think that if that's wrong, if you disagree that that's the right way of recasting it, then tell me another way. But I do think the argument needs to be recast from backward looking to something else, because we ain't got no traction left, if you know what I'm saying.
That's hard. That's really hard because, you know, we are American people, and Americans have a way of thinking that the rest of the world is very much other. And that's not to say that there aren't plenty of American people and plenty of Black American people who have an international perspective. But it seems to me that if you read about civil rights efforts, even in the 20th century, for a lot of the time, there was an idea that we needed to think on a more global level. And so you have Adam Clayton Powell going to the Bandung Conference in Indonesia representing Black people, or Du Bois going to Africa and conferences about all of
Bayard Rustin. Excuse me, I just want to say this. Bayard Rustin, who's the great assistant and deputy to A. Philip Randolph and helped organize the March on Washington and was also a consul to Martin Luther King. Bayard Rustin was in North Africa in the 1950s protesting the French who were testing their atomic weapon in the deserts of North Africa. And he met Nehru. He went to India and arrived just months after Gandhi was assassinated. So he was a guy, you know, with a really global understanding of what his human rights struggle was about.
He was a cosmopolitan leftist, and times have changed in many ways, and I think it's partly because so many good things did happen here, particularly in the mid and the late 60s. I think, you know, I find it hard to imagine, for example, say, a genuinely concerned person about Black America, such as Tavis Smiley or Michael Eric Dyson, being somebody who was as interested in thinking of us as one of a great many of the world's peoples who are enduring injustice and calling upon the whole world to condemn and to try to change, rather than having an aim against the evils of local whites right here in America and how whites feel about Clive and Bundy and people like Donald Sterling. I may lack imagination, but I feel like we've gotten down to very local terms in a sense that many people would feel that addressing it as a more global issue would be losing the point or making it more diffuse. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not sure I can see it. Some people more than others, Cornel West probably. But, you know, do you imagine Al Sharpton being terribly interested in talking to somebody from Vietnam? You know, I don't see it.
Well, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get what I was going to say is these people are very different from one another. So as you mentioned, Cornel West, who begins with he calls himself a Chekhovian Christian. That's Anton Chekhov, the turn of the 20th century Russian playwright. He calls himself, I mean, he's got a very broad view. Now, he and Tavis Smiley are quite close, and I have a lot of respect for Tavis Smiley, who I think is a deeply thoughtful person, as well as very effective as a spokesman. So I wouldn't want to say here that their horizons are so limited that they couldn't look beyond. Michael Eric Dyson's a different kettle of fish altogether, although he too can be quite articulate and, you know, he can also be preachy and pedantic, you know, but anyway.
Hey Glenn, if I may interject, I am not trying to make it sound like those are unsophisticated people in any way, but it's just that it seems to me that their main audience is a folk Black American audience and their concerns. And it seems to me that it would be a bit of a stretch to go from that concern of working with local Black communities and their concerns to having a global kind of message that it would be harder for many people to relate to. Anyway, go ahead.
No, so a guy like me who makes such a suggestion bears a burden of trying to set it out in such a way that I can encourage a kind of leadership, right? I mean, a kind of looking outside the box, thinking outside the box, looking beyond what we've been given, And the intellectuals, I'm not alone in this, are the ones, that's the class of the people that you look to lay the framework down, and then others might pick it up and take it somewhere, something like that. So there's a book that needs to be written, yet another book about race, but different than books that have been written about race in the past. A book that takes seriously our condition in the 21st century, including those social facts that a man like Cliven Bundy can observe and then twist into his own distorted caricature. But recognizing them, I mean, there's just, you know, the thing that was so, you said vomitous, and I like that word, John. The thing that I found so disturbing was I felt like, am I in a time machine? Did I just get taken back to the 1970s? Has nothing changed here in 40 years? Because these incidents led to Nostrums, you know. There aren't any black owners in the NBA. Well, the last time I checked, there was nothing to stop you from buying a basketball team. Hell, Russian oligarchs own basketball teams. If there aren't any black owners in the NBA, it's because nobody has the money that they're will- who is, happens to be black, that they're willing to invest in an NBA team. How did that get to be a national scandal? That's not a scandal. What? What? Did you want blacks to be subsidized to become owners in the NBA rather than to bring their own money to the table? I mean, please, well, that's a 1960s argument. I don't mean to seem to be insensitive to the point that there's racism in America, but you can buy an NBA team if you put the cash on the table. They're for sale.
Well, of course, I think that a lot of the answer is that there hasn't been enough time for most black people to accumulate that kind of capital. But to be honest, I have made that argument about various subjects in some circles, and people seem to receive it as somehow novel. I guess many people seem to think that there has been enough time. But and so what's enough? I mean, it's been 30 or 40 years since the 60s or the 70s. So maybe the idea is that that somehow should have been enough time for somebody to have had enough money, you know, George Jefferson, to make it fictitious, to buy himself a basketball team. But as far as I am concerned, it takes generations before things like that happen in the usual case. And it just hasn't been long enough. But Glenn, what you were saying about class versus race and affirmative action, I think, is very interesting, because that point has now become something that you can say in the public media and not, you know, not be squirted with water the way you used to. I mean, I talk about how I've been doing this for 15 years. 15 years ago, I came onto this scene as somebody who was saying exactly that. And in many circles, I was treated as somebody who was this backwards, elitist person who didn't understand a lot of the historical factors that we're talking about now. Whereas it's gone to the point that you can make that class argument, as many people, including me, actually did 3 weeks ago when that Supreme Court decision came down. And there are people who will disagree. But the idea that you're tilting at windmills and somebody who doesn't understand racism and saying it is no longer heterodox. And I think that that says that something really has happened. That argument, I do think you could get by, the idea that there's white poverty. Because if you think about it, it's not exactly new that the kind of dysfunction or unfortunate lives we're talking about is by no means limited to black people. Last time I checked, black people were insulted at the idea that we would associate the underclass pathologies with only black people. And Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed, has been teaching us about the white working poor for a very long time now. But something has tipped. And I think that that's probably a good thing, because I think you and I both know, for reasons good and bad, that a crusade against poverty probably has more of a chance in today's America than a crusade to redress the evils of Jim Crow, which I think just is not going to happen again.
Yeah, let me say this. I think the affirmative action debate and the tenuous position of liberals in the affirmative action controversy, which has been going on for nearly 40 years, you know, Bakke was 1978.
Yeah.
Is one reason why when you come out, or anybody comes out with class, not race, people get upset. And I should say for the record that in my own writing and research, I have taken the position that to replace affirmative action in colleges with a class-based system would not be able to sustain the same level of African-American and Latino involvement at these elite colleges. Because while, you know, blacks are disproportionately overrepresented amongst the poor, they're not disproportionately overrepresented amongst the poor with SAT scores high enough to get into Brown. Okay, so you go to class, not race, And if that's all you do, you're going to have fewer blacks at Brown. And if you think that's a bad thing, then, you know, you're against that. So I'm just saying that to say there's something special about that argument in the context of affirmative action. But what has changed, I think, is that that argument has carried the day in the context of affirmative action, not only at the Supreme Court, but also in the popular mind. You read the polling data. There are going to be more states that are going to ban racial affirmative action after the Supreme Court's upholding of the Michigan ban. And so, you know, the racial affirmative action in higher education, people are losing that battle. But I just want to say, my advocacy is more in the spirit of Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign of 1968 than it is to have anything to do with affirmative action. It's saying, put the government's feet to the fire in a serious way around the theme that we have many, many people with great needs that can be ameliorated to some extent by public action, and we need to mobilize politically in order to ameliorate it. In other words, this would be a critique that every time a politician says middle class, somebody would say, but what about the poor? And by saying that, they wouldn't mean the inner city specifically or necessarily. They would simply mean middle class, sure. Got nothing wrong with middle class. What about the poor? What about the poor? What about the poor?
Even if the poor are often not in a position to vote, what about the poor? Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why they're not saying it. Right. That's why they're not saying anything about the poor, because they want to win the elections. But the moral case on behalf of not sitting by and watching 20% of America slide off into the abyss is, I think, a winnable argument.
You know, something this ties into, though, is something that we talked about early in our Blogging Heads adventures. And you have asked me this question not too long ago, and I punted probably about a year ago. And I think now I'm responsible for addressing it, and I think that what we're just talking about plays right into it.
We're all listening, John.
This is President Obama, and as we all know, he is black.
Yeah.
And I thought back in the day that his being black, there being a black president, would have a positive effect on how race is processed in America by black people, by white people, and that it would help race relations. And you've asked me, well, is that true? And at some point I said it was too early to tell. But, you know, it's not now. It's been long enough. If there was going to be any difference, then we should at least see certain signs. And I have a couple, maybe 2.5 indications that something has happened, although, of course, history is mushy. But when I think about before Obama and what's going on today and whether or not they're causal relations, I think that there's a case to be made that the reason we're getting more comfortable with the sort of thing that you just mentioned, with, say, a revivification of King's latter-day poor people's movement, and the idea that if we're thinking about injustice, it's time to stop only thinking about The Wire, except for season 2, and think about all Americans. I think that part of it is because every day we see on our screens that there is this black president with his accomplished black wife and his obviously to be accomplished black children and all of his black friends, the Valerie Jarretts and the Eric Holders. Those people are in our faces in a way that they weren't 10 years ago. And I think that makes it a lot easier for people to process. Yes, there is a such thing as disadvantage in this country that needs to be addressed, but maybe the time has come that it doesn't need to be a matter of thinking of that as having a black face because of the man who's in the White House and the fact that he helps you think of other people like him. I don't think people are under the impression that he is this strange shooting star and that almost all other black people, you know, are getting by without a car. It's clear that black affluence is no longer the rarity that it once was. Stephen Carter's book, Yale, Black Law, Yale Professor, The Emperor of Ocean Park, that came out, I believe, in 2001, and he wrote about the kinds of black people who vacation on Martha's Vineyard.
Sorry to interrupt, but you've had a lot of air time. I get the point.
Okay.
I want to respond to that. At first, I thought there was going to be a mea culpa from you saying I was wrong, but that was wishful thinking on my part.
Sorry.
Here's what I have to say. An epic narrative control battle is brewing. That's about whether or not Obama's presidency will have been a success or a failure. The fight has already started. I followed David Remnick very closely, you know, the editor of The New Yorker, the guy who wrote this big book about Obama just after the campaign, during the campaign. I can't remember. I forget what the book is called, but it's The Bridge. The Bridge. Okay, so Obama. And you know, I read the columnist and, you know, everybody is getting in position to fight this fight. What has he accomplished? What has he done in the presidency? This is all by way of saying, in rebuttal to you, if he will have been judged to be a failure at this job, a neophyte who was unprepared to take on the responsibilities, the awesome responsibilities he assumed when he was inaugurated in 2009, and who has shown it by his incapacity and his lack of adroitness and skill at maneuvering amidst the sharks in the treacherous waters, which are American politics. It's been like that for a long time. If indeed his handling of foreign affairs, his equivocation and weakness, if indeed his incapacity to control his own caucus, to get anything done when he doesn't have a majority in both houses of Congress, if indeed his inability to control the narrative and the conversation in the country, is shown to have been what some people already are indicating that it might be, to wit, check out Maureen Dowd recently. No, she's not a political scientist. I understand that, okay?
But she's an
she's a cultural indicator. That's how
she
I'm
was
using
skeptical
her.
Of him from the beginning, yeah.
And pointing out that he's being eclipsed by the former president Bill Clinton and by the future president Hillary Rodham Clinton in terms of sucking all the air out of the room, these Clinton types, because Obama is not able to command the stage anymore. A lot of people are raising questions about his competency, about his performance on the job. So the battle is unfolding. David Remnick is running around saying, oh, no, he's doing a good job. He's great. I mean, blah, blah, blah. And he's got his apologists and he's got his defenders. And there's a case on his behalf. But there's also a case to suggest that he's screwed it up. You know, notwithstanding that he beat a weak candidate in Mitt Romney and got himself reelected amidst much manipulation and chicanery. Nevertheless, there's a case that he hasn't done the job very well at all. Many of us are not particularly impressed by his performance. So I say all that to say this. If the narrative goes down, if the defenders of Obama lose this epic battle and he becomes a two-term Jimmy Carter, then a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, it seems to me it goes in the other direction. You know, it seems to me that it militates against the favorable transformation that you'd like to have.
And it's interesting that you say that, because that brings me, I didn't expect to do all three of them in one utterance, but that brings me to my second point. Which is,
it would.
I really do think that it's going to come out not David Remnick's way. I mean, I openly admit that Obama was underprepared. He's not going to go down as a Jimmy Carter, but he's going to go down as moderately effective president. And you know what? I think that at this point, America has become, well, a certain segment of America has become much more comfortable with evaluating that mediocre president as a man than as some sort of black Jesus superstar. 5 or 6 years ago, people were not thinking of Barack Obama as a human being. They were thinking of him as Jesus. Yeah. And you had a lot of problems with that. I was kind of enjoying the show. Yeah. I probably was even a little bit of a part of it myself. I couldn't help it. Mm. But here we are now. And you know what? We've seen him mess up a great many times. And many people are going to deny this, but I'm not sure they're thinking about the people I'm thinking about. How racialized are we seeing the mess up? Now, okay, some idiot with a T-shirt or Clive and Bundy, but I think we can exaggerate about how influential the people out there are. And really, if we're thinking about us, the sort of people who read Slate, etc., I think all of us are much better at seeing Barack Obama as just a person than we were 5 or 6 years ago. And that's good. Now, if it turns out that people think, well, that's just what we expected of a black person anyway, okay, but I don't see that among America's thinking class. No, there's progress number two.
I think this is a really interesting point that you're making. I mean, surely it would be progress for an African-American to be able to ascend to the highest office in the land, do an okay but not especially spectacular job, and people just say, okay, well, there goes George W. Bush again, or somebody else who didn't.
Or somebody else.
Yeah, you know, but so what? Okay, he didn't do a great job, so what?
Harry
next
Truman.
Next case, yeah. And they don't ascribe it to race. That would be progress. I agree with you. But the counterpoint to that is Jackie Robinson could not just hit singles.
No.
He had to steal home.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have been Jackie Robinson.
That is true. And Obama is no Jackie Robinson.
But so it would appear.
These are different times. And so, and I really had thought of this before, you know, that he is a mediocre president. And it's interesting how that isn't looking as black as it would have 10 years ago. You know,
John, you're
going to
get hate mail. I'm just telling you now. You're going to get hate mail. And by the way, Blogging Heads audience, John McWhorter, not Glenn Lowry. John McWhorter said that.
Fire away, everybody. But I do believe that. And Glenn, can I give you the briefer third indication?
I'll let you close us out with that because I got to go to another meeting.
Okay. The hip-hop revolution is something that I think you knew everybody was talking a whole lot about during the aughts. That was something that was on a lot of people's minds. Many of them were taken rather seriously, that that music was going to create some sort of profound change for black people, and, you know, short of anything else. Yes. As soon as Barack Obama was elected, all, well, not all of it, most of the chatter about that just fell away. People don't stand up and ask it in audiences anymore. The number of books that are about that slowed down to a trickle almost immediately. I think that Obama's rise created a more concrete sense of some sort of possible racial progress than the fantastical notion that people saying things to a catchy beat was somehow going to be fashioned into politics. I think there was an Obama effect there, and I was glad to see that. That's the third thing.
That's an interesting point, because I just saw Nas, the rapper, who's got a reissue of his 1994, I think, album that was such a big hit at that time, in an interview say almost exactly what you just said.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Check it out.
Okay, so I'm not completely crazy on number three. Okay.
Yeah, that people are were over freighting hip hop with political significance and whatnot, and that Obama's ascendancy has kind of shown that, you know, you didn't need to have a bunch of guys who were just trying to tell the truth about what it was like to be on the street carry all the weight,
right?
You know, of African American political expression, protest, and critique, because it had moved out of the streets and into the suites.
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought that that was a kind of progress here, and here we are in 2014. So that's my answer to the question about Obama. It's mixed. I think that there has been some difference, but it certainly has not been anything like magic.
All right, John McWhorter, I'm not going to give them your email address. They'll find it on their own. Take care. Thanks for coming on the Glenn Show, man.
You too, Glenn. Talk to you very soon.
Yeah, bye.